Welcome to another episode of the First Principles of Medicine podcast. Today we've got a very special guest, Dr. Matt Morgan. Matt is an ICU consultant I met on rotation when I was at Royal Perth Hospital. And he's a great teacher, and he was teaching me all about the first principles. And then I looked him up and I found out he was an author. So I decided to contact him to get him on the podcast. So I think Matt will be going through out-of-hospital cardiac arrest today. And we've also got two other guests with me, Aidan and Josh, who've been on the podcast before.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Good to be back.
And to just give you the context of what type of teacher Matt is, he's the type of guy who, when I was on the wards, there was a patient who was quite thin and possibly cachectic and anorexic. And he asked me, what's the relationship between this patient and David Blaine? And I was thinking to myself, like, this is going to be up there with the most random questions consultants ever ask me. But it turned out to be relevant because he was explaining to me how David Blaine did an experiment where he starved himself for 90 days and then they analyzed him scientifically and he got a publication, which I think is pretty worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you want to introduce yourself, Matt, as well.
Yeah, thank you for that introduction. Yeah, I think David Blaine may be one of the only professional magicians who's got a New England Journal paper on his CV. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So thank you for the kind introduction. Yeah, Matt Morgan, I work as an intensive care consultant in Western Australia, but now I'm back in South Wales, or Old South Wales, as you Australians may like to call it. So I'm in near Cardiff, working in quite a big, busy intensive care unit, around 40 beds. That's my day job. And outside of that, as you mentioned, I've written two books, one called Critical, Stories and Science from the Brink of Life, which is all about stories and science about intensive care patients, really. And the second one, which is published just this year gone, called One Medicine, which is all about how understanding animals can save your life. Why does a kangaroo have three vaginas, and what can it teach us about IVF, and how does a giraffe breathe, for example? So available from all good and bad bookshops. But today, I've been asked to talk about out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
What do you want to go through?
Yeah, so I guess, first of all, history, as Jason knows, after being on endless ward rounds with me, I like a bit of history to start off a topic. And out-of-hospital cardiac arrest has got a great history, actually. Some people think it goes back to Shelley's book, Frankenstein, bringing people to life with electricity. That was 1818, but actually it was 30 years before that, when the first successful use of electric shocks for resuscitation was reported by a slightly crazy English surgeon called Charles Kite. It was in 1788. And there was a little three-year-old girl called Sophie who fell from a window in London. And surprisingly, the neighbours came out to find her on the ground, apparently dead. But actually, this guy had been experimenting with static electricity stored in a special kind of glass jar. And he put that on her chest. And when he put it through her chest, her neighbour said a small pulse came back. And within a few minutes, the child began to breathe with great difficulty. And she was completely normal within a week. There's another good bit of history, if I'm allowed to swear on your podcast, and the famous saying, blowing smoke up one's arse. So that comes from, again, in the 1800s, there were actually smoke bellows along the River Thames and other places that they thought would resuscitate people from drowning. And unfortunately, they put those bellows at people's back ends rather than mouths, which... in retrospect, wasn't a great idea and didn't work. So don't try this at home. So that's, I guess, a bit of the history of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. But what do we see nowadays? Well, if you look at 100 people who have an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, around 20 of them will survive to hospital. So about 20 of them, if you like, will get ROSC, which is a key word to know in your exams, or return of spontaneous circulation. But there's an important bit to that, and that is the fact that immediate CPR can double or maybe even quadruple survival from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And yet, less than half, probably about 40% of people, receive bystander CPR. And what's more, early defibrillation, like we looked at in the history of electricity use, can improve survival rates up to 50% too, with each minute of delay reducing survival by about 10%. So it's really critical in what we call this chain of survival that people have bystander CPR. And there's two kind of important time points that we think about then when I meet a patient in the intensive care unit. When I'm listening to the handover, there's two kind of times that I'm thinking about. One is called no flow time. And that's kind of obvious. That's when you've had an arrest. There's no CPR. You are dead. No flow. And the other is low flow time. And that is when you've had a cardiac arrest, but you are having effective CPR. So you may have some flow, yeah. i.e. low flow. So those are two kind of key timings to think about when you're receiving a handover of patients like that. And then looking at statistics in general, I think in ICU, we've been quite guilty sometimes of nihilism. And that's the case with a number of critical conditions. It's been the case for cardiac arrest. It's been the case for things like COPD. It's been the case now perhaps for liver cirrhosis, when we get patients admitted with decompensated liver cirrhosis, we can feel a little bit nihilistic that, oh, this is all terrible and you know, nobody ever survives. But actually, we've been proven wrong with conditions like COPD. And similarly, if you look at cardiac arrest survival, out of those 100 people who arrest, 20 of them reach hospital alive. Out of those 20, about 10 of them will survive the intensive care unit. And out of those 10, maybe around 5 or 8 will leave hospital. So actually, you know, once you get to hospital, the survival is about 50%, and the return to what could be considered an acceptable quality of life, that you can look after your own bodily functions and even return to work, it's about 50%. So, you know, it's kind of better than septic shock in many ways. So I think we have been septic shock. Yeah. You know, if you think about the survival from septic shock in the most severe cases, maybe around 30%, people with multi-organ failure, you know, get into hospital alive after a cardiac arrest is better than that.
So if you don't mind, going through like the first principles of kind of cardiac arrest. So the main thing we're kind of concerned about is just blood flow to the brain and then just that hypoxia causing brain damage, essentially.
So. Yeah, spot on. You know, the mode of death generally after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, if you get to hospital, tends to be neurological damage, so cerebral hypoxia. That's often the mode of death. Yes, there will be some patients who also die from severe shock, but most of the time it's that. So most of the principles we use pre-hospital and early in hospital admissions tries to preserve that function. Now, we can't undo any damage which has already been done by lack of blood supply to the brain, but we can try and prevent further complications from that. And that's really why early effective CPR is so, so important. You know, there have been other therapies trialled to prevent this, such as rapid early pre-hospital cooling and cooling in hospital as well. But the evidence is very much out on whether that is truly effective or not. There was a big study done in Australia, which looked at cooling cardiac arrest survivors in the intensive care unit that was thought to show much better neurological survival. But actually, over the last decade, it's been shown that it's probably the effect of having a high temperature, which is bad, rather than having a low temperature, which is good. And so nowadays, we tend to prevent fever rather than actively cool people to a low temperature.
Sorry, Matt, would you be able to quickly go through, I guess, why we would try to avoid fevers and why that's potentially, I guess, what, neurotoxic, is it?
Yeah, well, the truth is we don't fully know. We know from animal models and from theoretical models that fever induces a number of changes in the body, pro-inflammatory cytokines, neurotoxicity, direct neuronal death, which may contribute to neurological damage. And, you know, that's been shown in animal models as well as basic science. So that's probably the root to it. But there's also other factors. We know that your cerebral metabolic rate can be reduced through cooling. And so perhaps is there a protective effect there? But the truth is, nowadays, the guidelines suggest that fever prevention is probably the way to go after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, rather than active cool into a low temperature, although this is not universally accepted globally. And there are centres that are still using cooling after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. There is a big new trial being planned by a European group, which will be a global trial of trying to answer this very question.
Okay, I was just going to say, Aidan had a pretty interesting experience on cardiothoracics.
So I was going to say, like, is that the same principle as in, like, CABGs, where they induce deep hypothermic arrest to preserve, like, to reduce metabolic rate and preserve the organs? Like, similar sort of principle that ICU was using for that?
Yeah, similar, but with one important difference in terms of when you use deep hypothermic arrest, especially for things like aortic arch surgery, which involves the carotids, you cool people before the arrest happens, okay? And this is a similar principle to when survival happens when people fall into frozen lakes, for example. In fact, in my second book, I interview a guy called Casper, who lives in Copenhagen, and he was one of seven children who fell into a frozen lake during a dragon boat race. And all seven children had a cardiac arrest and died for up to 6 hours. And all seven children survived to mostly a very good functional state. And that shows the importance of pre-cooling or rapid cooling. The difference with out-of-hospital arrest is the arrest has already happened. So you're cooling people after the index event. And so maybe that's important.
So you'd rather be cold and...
Yeah, cold before you... I was going to say, did they have too much to say as to what went on in that 6 hours when they were down?
Yeah, well, the truth was it was a super cold lake, i.e. it was below freezing point, which water can do, especially salt water. And that probably reduced the cerebral metabolic rate to such an extent and induced ancient reflexes that we have as mammals through evolution, the diving reflex and other things. And so those children were mostly put on to ECMO, onto VV and VA ECMO for a period and very gradually rewarmed. And that was probably how they survived. And there's other evidence from other animals. There's salamanders in Russia that can survive frozen tundra conditions for you know, for a very long period of time frozen. So that's probably the evidence behind deep hypothermic arrest, as you mentioned. But cardiac arrest is different because of the time point, and that perhaps that's why we haven't seen the benefits of cooling, because the index event has already happened.
And I always wondered, with just going back to like CPR, when you're actually physically doing CPR, you're really trying to compress that heart. And it's always kind of like, it's hard to like imagine, like, are you, because you're trying. It's just such a basic thing to do. Like
Yeah, when it comes down to it, it is just like a...
I love how advanced everything is in medicine, and literally the best we can come up with is just going to...
Pressing on the chest. And again, there's a history to that. That has gone through a lot of evolution over the years. It used to be CPR was done by putting arms up and down over your head. In fact, there's a Sherlock Holmes book which describes somebody who is hung by a rope, and Watson cuts him down and puts his arms up and down as a pump, if you like. not very effective. But CPR actually isn't just squeezing the heart. There's a pull and a push effect. Because of interpleural pressure changes, there is a suck-in effect of blood coming out of the heart as well as the physical squeezing. And of course, we do have some technology nowadays. We have automated mechanical support devices. The Lucas is the most common. Although, the evidence shows it probably doesn't directly improve survival. But what it does do is free up people to do other things. You know, if you're trying to put somebody on VA ECMO during CPR, you're not going to want teams of people doing manual CPR. By the way, do you know how you do CPR in animals like a tortoise that has a shell? How would you do CPR in a tortoise?
I believe Josh is out.
Oh, yeah. I'm the veterinarian. No, if there's not a soft part, no, I'm real.
Did you say on a tortoise?
Yeah, on a tortoise. Tortoise with a shell. So would you do CPR on a tortoise?
Would you like try to
keep open like a boiled egg?
I don't know. You move the arms up and down?
No, you just turn it over.
It's got a soft belly, does it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. How many turtles I've resuscitated.
Again, there's a vague practical point to that in terms of in COVID, of course, lots of patients in the intensive care unit were prone, relying on their front. Mm-hmm. And there is some evidence that doing CPR prone by pressing on the spines of somebody's back for the similar reasons, push and pull effect, can be effective. So if you ever find somebody who's on their front, it's best to turn them over like a tortoise. But if you can't, then you could probably do prone CPR. Yeah.
Ah. I'd rather a fractured rib than a fractured vertebral body.
Yeah, because I always talk about rib fractures. Yeah. Imagine just, oh my God. Yeah.
Matt, can I? I'm on ED at RPH at the time, at the moment. And something that a lot of the AMBOs will mention when they bring a patient in who's had a cardiac arrest, they talk about something called downtime. And it's not something that I've spent much time looking into. And how does that differ to low flow and high flow time that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, it's a good question. And downtime is a catch-all term for both that no flow and that low flow time. So if you do get a handover that says, 20 minutes downtime, it would be good to question that a little bit further and say, okay, you know, was there bystander CPR? How long was the delay between cardiac arrest and bystander CPR? And how long was the CPR done for? So then if the downtime, if you like, is 20 minutes, it may be that they only had 1 minute of no flow time, i.e. no CPR, in which case perhaps the outcomes will be better. Mm. If, on the other hand, somebody had a downtime of 20 minutes and there was no CPR for 20 minutes, then, you know, the outcomes may be very different. So, and I guess one thing to say about that, you know, although we concentrate on the medicine, doing CPR on somebody you know, somebody you love, or even a stranger is a really tough thing to do. You know, even in a hospital environment where we do it, it can be quite impactful for staff, especially long resuscitation, especially children, especially the elderly, where you may get a kind of a moral injury. But for a wife doing it to a husband, or a mum doing it to a daughter or a son, you know, it's a massive thing. And so there's a lot of importance around the language and support in families who come in after having done CPR on someone. And the kind of language that I use, you know, I'll say to a relative, oh, look, you know, whoever helped and did CPR did absolutely the right thing. If it wasn't for your hard work, we probably wouldn't be here now at all. We can't undo any damage which has already been done, but you've given them the best chance of getting through this. So, you know, well done. You've done everything right. Mm. And I say that, you know, even if somebody hasn't done CPR, that language is still pretty inclusive. I'll say something like, you did absolutely the right thing. You call for help as soon as you can. You know, well done for doing that. If it wasn't for your hard work, we may not be here now. Because there's a huge amount of guilt often in families caring after you care for people. And they often think, you know, should I have done more? What if I'd done X, Y, and Z. And it's good to address that front on sometimes.
And Matt, just a question about CPR as well, because like not everyone is done a basic life support course and knows like CPR is trained by St. John, for example, but everybody would have seen something about CPR. So they know like, oh, you got to squeeze the chest and all that kind of stuff. So in terms of the effectiveness of CPR, has anyone sort of said like someone who has never been trained in CPR but does CPR, does that still have an effect in saving someone's life as opposed to someone who knows exactly, you know, the rate and the cadence and everything?
Yeah, the take-home message is any CPR is better than no CPR. And I think we've swung in terms of training courses used to be really detailed, you know, two fingers here, do this, do that, the other. And what we now know, as I said, you know, having CPR probably doubles or quadruples your survival. And yet less than half of people who have a cardiac arrest in the community will have CPR. So the really important thing is, yes, quality is important, but getting it people to do it at all is the important thing. And so that is why the guidelines nowadays and the training are a lot more liberal. You know, compressions only is now taught, you know, because there was a lot of worry about mouth to mouth and the effectiveness of that. So it's compressions only in the community for most of the time. And the instructions are pretty simple. You know, put your hands together, place them in the center of the chest, press down until you feel the chest move. And the rate, you know, you can do it to a song rhythm. The classic one is the Bee Gees' Staying Alive, which is a good song to think about. And, you know, do that until the ambulance arrives. So we've got a lot more liberal with that. There are some differences. So in children, the cause of cardiac arrest, you know, in adults, the cause of cardiac arrest is broadly a heart cause or a non-heart cause. About 50-50 probably. And a non-heart cause can include anything, but the common ones will be drugs, respiratory failure, brain issues. Those are probably some of the big ones. But in children, the causes are very different, i.e. it's much less likely you've got a primary cardiac cause, although not impossible, and much more likely it's something else like drowning or choking or pneumonia or something else. So rescue breaths in children still probably play an important part. But even so, yeah, CPR is a lot more liberally taught nowadays.
Yeah. But like just moving on from CPR, in terms of like we're always taught the non-shockable and shockable pathway. And this is one like pet peeve of mine, which I never understand. I think it's from, so like growing up, you know, you always see like ER or like any TV show, you see the asystole where there's no heartbeat. Okay.
No,
And you're like, they get the shock pads ready. Yeah. They like Mr. Bean gets it ready, you know, like in the movies and shocks him. But it really confused me like earlier, like last year when we were learning CPR and stuff, that asystole is a non-shockable rhythm. And I just cannot wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
Like why that would not be the case, because it makes sense to me. Oh, you shock it, right? Like get the rhythm back, like restart it.
Give some juice.
Yeah, I think it's probably the concept restart the heart with electricity. It doesn't really restart the heart. It actually stops it. And so if the heart has already stopped, then you don't want to stop it again. So, you know, if you have pulseless VT or VF, the use of electricity really is to terminate that abnormal rhythm and then hope the heart's intrinsic rhythm kicks back in. But if you have asystole or, you know, complete heart block or PEA, for example, which are the classic non-shockable rhythms, you don't want to terminate a rhythm. There's nothing to terminate with asystole. You just want to treat the underlying cause. Yeah. So I think probably the phrase, you know, restart a heart is, it's not like jumpstart in your car where you're providing electricity to start. You're actually trying to terminate a rhythm.
Yeah, that's a good way of understanding it, because it never made any sense.
I actually wanted to ask, Matt, what really is the underlying kind of process that's happening when you shock the heart to restart or to stop it and then hope that it restarts and it's more like a sinus rhythm. Do you just like depolarize all the myocardial cells at once and then they all go into a refractory mode and then hope that it starts up again? Like, what's actually going on when you zap someone?
Yeah, that's spot on. And you remember all of the electrical potential, all the EP voltages in fast sodium channels and that intrinsic depolarization rate. So what you're basically doing is resetting all of that. Now, what it doesn't do is fix underlying issues. So if you've got an underlying conduction issue, like complete heart block, or if you've got so much ischemia that it's causing your muscle, your ventricle to go crazy and fibrillate, you know, it won't necessarily fix that, but it will, you know, like turning your computer off and back on, it will reset things, and hopefully the intrinsic electricity of the heart will reset. There are also some changes to the way we use defibrillation. I guess the important things to think about are when you're doing that, you're trying to reduce as much as you can the impedance that human bodies give to the passage of current. That's effectively what you're doing. So you can place pads in different positions, not only lateral, but you can use AP, so front and back pad placement. That may help in people who are obese, for example, or have large breasts, or have other reasons for high impedance. And it's different when you're shocking somebody who doesn't have a cardiac arrest for things like AF or SVT than when they do have a cardiac arrest. You have to what's called synchronize shocks for people who don't have a cardiac arrest to prevent the development of things like VF and VT. I guess the other thing to say is increasingly there's use of AEDs, automatic external defibrillators, in the community, which also gives you instructions for CPR. And increasingly there are patients who have implantable defibrillators, you know, people with heart failure, for example. So those are some special cases that you may want to adapt what you do.
Just
because with the cardiac arrest pathway, shock, non-shockable, and then the other things we're often taught, like we have to commit to memory, are the like uses of adrenaline and amiodarone. And it just seems like we're just chucking stuff at the wall, just hoping one of them works. I don't know if you have any comment on those.
Well, there's been a good study with the use of adrenaline in pre-hospital cardiac arrest. It was done in the UK. It was a tricky study to do because you're randomizing people during a cardiac arrest to adrenaline or placebo. It was done, and it was a very well designed study. You know, to get it done at all was amazing. And the outcome of that was adrenaline works, but it depends on what your definition of work is. So, you know, there's two important bits to a cardiac arrest. First of all, you need to not be dead. So you need to survive. If you ask patients what's the most important thing for them, if they were to have a cardiac arrest, what's the most important thing? They probably wouldn't say not to be dead. They would probably say, well, I'd want to go back to work, or I'd want to see my family, or I'd want to be able to walk again. Or, you know, what often they would describe is survival in a neurological state that's acceptable to them. And in this study, it showed that the use of adrenaline, yes, it improves survival, but it doesn't improve survival with good neurological outcome, which perhaps you could argue is the important thing. But, you know, adrenaline is still in the guidelines. It's still used. So, you know, you should still follow those published pathways. But there is a reasonable debate about what are the endpoints of cardiac arrest studies like that. And then amiodarone, you mentioned, of use in people who've got refractory VF and VT. So sometimes when you have a crazy big heart attack, that can make all of your ventricular muscle go haywire. And despite shocking people, reset in it, as we've mentioned, you will then just degenerate back into VF or VT. So in those circumstances, you probably want to use a drug or a therapy that can either fix the problem or make the myocardial muscles settle down. And there are many options. Amiodarone is the one in the guidelines. There's others like lignocaine, or there's even fancy therapies like going on to ECMO or having a stent, for example. Mm. In fact, in my first book, Critical, available from all bad bookshops, there's a case of a judge who had a cardiac arrest in the middle of court. The clerk of court did CPR on him for about 20 minutes. He came into the ED I was working, the intensive care unit I was working in. He had about 20 cardiac arrests in total during the next couple of hours. And he had what we call VF storm because of a massive heart attack. And it was only having a stent placed and actually having a balloon pump, which managed to settle down that VF storm because his heart was so unhappy. And he's now back to work. He's a granddad. He's got two new grandchildren. He's functionally normal, pretty much. Yeah. And again, that's the amazing thing about cardiac arrest. It's easy to be nihilistic when you see somebody having CPR, but it's hard to imagine them back to life. But that is what happens to some people.
I was wondering Josh.
You take it, Adrian. That's right.
All right. Just a question about the ROSC or the return of spontaneous circulation in patients who only have CPR. How does the actual CPR make someone make their hearts start working again?
So you can get into a bit of a vicious cycle with cardiac arrest in that, it may be something like a single episode of VT or VF. That then reduces the coronary blood flow to the heart and to the brain. That then makes the VF and VT worse. That can then degenerate into asystole, for example, and PEA. So what CPR is really doing in those circumstances is A, providing blood to the brain, and B, providing a little bit of coronary perfusion. And maybe that will be enough just to get over that initial insult. There are some other mechanisms. If you've had a PE, for example, maybe CPR mechanically can have some benefits in terms of that. If you've got a respiratory cause of arrest, like a choking or an aspiration, CPR could, in theory, dislodge things so you could breathe again. But most of the time, it's trying to get out of that vicious cycle. It doesn't fix a massive heart attack, of course, but it may give enough coronary perfusion to allow the heart to continue to function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. All right. I was going to ask if you could explain simply, because I'm very simple. Nice. So I now understand why defibrillation works basically in cardiac arrest. How does adrenaline work to reorganize the cardiac rhythm?
Yeah, good question. I guess like most things in medicine, the most important words we don't say enough are three little words, which are I don't know. They are hard to say, but we probably should say them more often.
I often say that. We know
adrenaline is a natural endogenous catecholamine. It acts on alpha and beta receptors. It's an agonist at those receptors. So if you have some conditions which like severe sepsis or Addisonian syndrome, or your heart rhythm is degenerated into something like asystole, then beta agonism can help prevent that. It also acts on your vasculature, both veno and arterial constriction. So it may act in those ways. But as we said in the study that was done, it probably improves survival by giving you a blood pressure and a heart rhythm, but it doesn't necessarily improve survival with good neurological outcome.
Yeah, no. I've got a very personal story when it comes to out-of-hospital cardiac arrest was, it's a very bittersweet thing, but my dad was playing hockey and he had a fall and he had a cardiac arrest. Oh. And very luckily for him was that there were a lot of doctors and nurses around because for some reason a lot of them play hockey. and he actually got CPR, I think within a couple of minutes or a minute max. So he got that car, he got like immaculate CPR, in my opinion. And it went to the hospital. It turns out later he actually had a spinal cord injury, a C1 spinal cord injury, which possibly led to the cardiac arrest. There's a lot of confusion over whether he had a cardiac arrest and then a spinal cord injury, or spinal cord injury first, then cardiac arrest. And what's incredible now is that I've realized, like, especially since my time in the ICU, how lucky he is in a way that he survived this spinal cord injury, but he's retained pretty much perfect brain function. Like, he's lost no memory, still doing Sudokus and doing old men stuff. And literally it's just because he got CPR within like a minute or so on the hockey pitch, which is crazy because his quality of life, whilst it's reduced right now in his position, is still way better because he can still have conversations with his friends and family because he got the CPR within a few minutes.
Wow. Well, you know, that's an incredible story, and you know, it sounds tough and good, as you said. I guess one important thing to say from that story is traumatic cardiac arrest is a very different beast than non-traumatic. And I know there's some uncertainty with your dad of chicken or the egg, you know, was it a fall, a fracture, an arrest, or vice versa? But just the nature, we've said that out-of-hospital cardiac arrest can be mostly caused by cardiac causes. In traumatic cardiac arrest, you know, that's very different. The cause may well be hypovolemia, pneumothorax, spinal cord injury, as you've mentioned. And so because of that, the kind of treatment, if you like, of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest isn't always necessarily just CPR. Because if the problem isn't with the heart, then just pressing on the heart harder and harder probably won't help. You know, the treatment is very much find the problem, fix the problem. If it's bilateral pneumothoraces, drain the pneumothoraces. If it's massive blood loss, give blood. If it's spinal cord injury, then, you know, there's some more complexities to that. I guess one other entity which is important for you to know about, because it's increasingly recognized and is a new entity, you know, it wasn't described when I was training, is called something called brain impact apnea. And this has really been described by pre-hospital care services, which they're often called to attend a scene of somebody who's had a relatively minor head injury but ends up having CPR and ends up having cardiac arrest. And it turns out, for unknown reasons, even having relatively minor blows to the head in, you know, hockey matches or AFL or other things, for some reason it can cause your body to just go into apnea, and so you don't breathe and you appear to be dead. The good news is that, you know, if you treat that early and effectively with breaths and or CPR, you know, it's pretty easy to fix. And, you know, it may even be that your dad, from his spinal cord injury, you know, had a degree of brain impact apnea or apnea because of the spinal cord injury. And what we know is the outcomes after that kind of cardiac arrest, if treated early and appropriately, are good. And so it really empowers people, you know, if you're at sports matches, if you're a first aider, or if you're just a member of the community, you know, you can do things which are more impactful than we can in the intensive care unit. You know, you can have much more effect on someone's life and survival with just your hands and calling for help than we can with, you know, machines that cost tens of thousands of dollars in a complex intensive care unit.
Amazing. Aside from CPR, what other things, like, because you mentioned adrenaline doesn't improve the survival, it improves the survival but not the sort of neurological benefits from that, what are some things that do improve that aside from timely CPR?
Yes, it probably falls into three main categories. The first we've talked about a lot, which is good chain of survival. So, you know, early CPR, identifying the issue, calling for help, early defibrillation, all of those things, pre-hospital stuff. Then we talked a little bit about cooling, and the studies are yet to be done, but it may well be fever prevention helps, you know, improve neurological survival. And the third thing, which sounds obvious, is fixing the problem. You know, when someone comes into ICU with an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, you support the organs to give them time and try and identify what the problem is and fix it. And so that may be going to the cath lab, that may be identifying a PE which needs treatment, or an infection or pneumonia. You know, short of that, there are no other magic cures, although there's lots of research looking at things like the use of inhaled xenon and fancy stem cell stuff. You know, there's lots of research, but nothing concrete. What we do have, which is the most important thing, which is probably the most important thing in intensive care, is time. And what we know is that in the past, perhaps people moved to what we call prognostication too early during out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So somebody comes in, they've had, you know, 20, 30 minutes of CPR, they're pretty ill, they're on a ventilator in ICU. 24 hours later, you turn off the sedation, they're not doing anything, they're not waking up, and maybe you'll stop at that point or talk to the family and say, oh, look, you know, this is all not looking good. What we know is, especially when cooling is used, and especially when people have things like kidney injury after cardiac arrest, or have been on drugs like opioids, delayed neuroprognostication, you know, after 36, 72, 96 hours, is associated with better survival rates with good neurological survival. So the key is, in general, to not, you know, make those big prognostic decisions too early. And when you do move to prognosis, it should be from lots of different perspectives. So maybe from scans, maybe from blood tests, maybe from electricity tests like EEGs or SSEPs, from clinical examination. And maybe you'll want to get a neurologist involved as well as an intensive care doctor. So I think that's one big take-home message, is not to be too nihilistic. Yes, people still die, of course, but not prognosticating too early may be helpful.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt, for going through that. I think it was actually nice to just be able to ask those stupid kind of questions.
Yeah, how afraid to ask other people. How does CPR save someone's life?
Yeah. Like, you learn it, but sometimes you don't really understand it, and we really appreciate that. Just before you head off, I know you're running short of time, I just wanted you to go through what your new book is about, because I think it's something our listeners would, because I think you really fit in with our vibe of understanding and understanding like the physiology and the pharmacology before really moving on. If you could touch upon your new book, that'd be great.
Yeah, well, you know, the truth is actually the first book was very much about intensive care and our kind of day-to-day job and the patient stories related to that. The second book was very different, and I was actually looking after somebody who'd had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest from a more unusual cause. They had actually choked on a biscuit, a very British biscuit called a hobnob. And we were looking after them in the intensive care unit. Probably one of the best biscuits out there, by the way. And as we were looking after them, there was a flock of birds flying past the window, because the intensive care unit's on the third floor where I work. And that morning, I'd cycled to work. I had a load of flies on my face because it was the summer, I was cycling to work. And I wondered, why don't birds inhale and have cardiac arrests? You know, not on biscuits, but on flies or things. So I spent that night, I was meant to be revising for my intensive care exams, and instead I bought a book, which is still on my shelf behind me, called Animal Physiology by Smit Nielsen. It's on the bookshelf there. And I tried to work out why birds don't inhale and have a cardiac arrest. And that then spawned my interest in, I guess, comparative physiology and understanding how animals can help save lives. And the stories are pretty remarkable. You know, why does a kangaroo have three vaginas? How can it help IVF? How does a giraffe breathe? How can it help us care for patients with asthma? How do ants manage pandemic disease? And the secret is they manage it much better than we do, as well as some of the kind of mental health and other aspects. You know, animals use drugs. Dolphins rub up against pufferfish on purpose to get high. Monkeys drink alcohol to excess. And why is that? So really the book kind of weaves stories of animals and humans together. And, you know, it's quite lighthearted, but there is a serious message to it in that, you know, we tend to meet animals nowadays mainly as a fill-in in our sandwich. That wasn't always the case. We used to have a much closer relationship, understand how their bodies work. And why is it that human medicine, which is just one species, and animal medicine, which is every other species on the planet, are so removed? You know, why aren't vets and doctors training together? Mm. Why the department's not one? Why don't we have the same oath together rather than an oath for one species and not for every other species? So there's a bit of seriousness in there, but there's also a lot of comedy. Mm. It's called One Medicine, How Understanding Animals Can Save Your Life. There's an audiobook if you'd want to listen to it on your commute to work, or as I say, it's in all bad bookshops, including a few signed copies in bookshops around Perth, especially there's one in Claremont Quarter, which is...
Did you narrate the audiobook version?
I did, yeah. Although there is a step change in my voice about halfway through, because I had an accidental hangover myself halfway through the recording, so you might notice that.
No, but thank you again for having a chat with us. We'll definitely be giving away a few copies of your book, so for any listeners who just listened to the episode, we'll be giving people those details for how to get one. But thank you again, Matt. That was a really interesting talk.
Perfect. Thank you. And just for your audience listening again, you know, you can go out today, learn how to do CPR. You may well save somebody's life tomorrow, the next day, the day after. It's not complex. Press on the chest if somebody has no signs of life, not breathing normally. It's a really impactful thing that anyone can do, and a great time to learn, a great time to teach others in your family, and go from there.
Cool. Beautiful. Great.
Thanks.
Great message.
Awesome.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.